This edition of The Recap was first broadcast on the 4th of April 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Recap, bringing you the past week's best highlights from the news and analysis programs broadcast here on Monocle 24. I am Markus Hippi. Over the next half hour, we'll bring you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, Midori House and The Monocle Daily. Coming up, we debate the UK election in the first in a series of in-depth roundtable discussions on the topic. Also ahead on the program,
I think the kind of particularly boisterous brand of nationalism that Putin has been unleashing in Russia recently also, you know, really taps into that sentiment of fighting against the fascists.
An excerpt from Midori House there, where we learned why, despite being responsible for the deaths of many of his countrymen, many Russians still have a soft spot for Joseph Stalin. Also,
in terms of it being Sunni or Shia, well, it certainly, from what we've seen in the last couple of days, it's very focused on gathering sort of Sunni majority countries across the region and uniting them against this perceived Iranian threat.
Monday's edition of The Briefing there, where we hear about the new outlook for the Arab League nations. That's all coming up and much more in the next half hour, right here on The Recap with me, Markus Hippi. The Arab League summit closed on Sunday in Sharm el-Sheikh, and with it, Arab leaders agreed on the formation of a unified regional force to help counter growing threats to security. According to the summit's final declaration, membership in the force will be voluntary. On Monday's edition of The Briefing, Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck spoke with Cairo contributor Ruth Michelson, who had been following the summit closely.
What we've heard is that it would be 40,000 elite troops based in either Cairo or Riyadh. There would be some air support, there would be some warships as well. The thing to remember is that this isn't moving especially quickly. This is just the beginning of a discussions of how to do this, how it would be financed. We're hearing that the meetings to do that will happen within the next month. So I don't think we're going to see this force rolling out into Libya and Yemen in the next couple of days.
How much of a force is it these days, you know, the Arab League? Because does it cover the whole region? You know, many of the nations here seem to be setting that the pace seems to be on the Sunni side of things. But does it actually bring together the Shia, Sunni? Is it a real force still?
The stereotype about the Arab League is that a lot is discussed and then not a lot gets done. So, for example, if you look at the decisions that were made on Palestine, it was very much sort of discussing what to do about the UN Security Council and then kind of tabling it for later. This is very much sort of the stereotype of what happens at Arab League meetings. There's a lot of intent and then no action. In terms of it being Sunni or Shia, well, it certainly, from what we've seen in the last couple of days, it's very focused on gathering sort of Sunni majority countries across the region and uniting them against this perceived Iranian threat. So that's very focused on the power of the Gulf Cooperation Council countries, mainly Saudi Arabia, and backed very, very heavily by Egypt, who is a big partner of Saudi Arabia.
And I love the fact that there's been a few tiffs on the side as well, or a few intrigues anyway. So they read a statement out from Vladimir Putin saying that Russia was keen on solving the crises in Syria, Libya and Yemen through dialogue and national reconciliation. Then the Saudi foreign minister jumped up immediately and denounced that. The Qataris oddly gave their backing to Brother Sisi, the leader of Egypt, but kind of were trying to warn out against military intervention in Libya. A few spats and things on the agenda as well.
Yeah, the smackdown by the Saudi foreign minister was quite something. So there was, as you say, there was this statement read out by Putin, which sort of seemed to have Russia trying to position itself as a mediator for regional conflicts, saying that they want the conflicts in the region resolved through peaceful means. And the Saudi Arabian foreign minister immediately got on the mic and said, well, sorry, but that's not reasonable. You're sending arms to Bashar al-Assad. How can you say this? And as you say, there was some interesting sort of split decision-making, if you like, by the Qatari emir, who said, very unusually, brother Sisi, called Sisi his brother, which is sort of interesting because you have, at the moment, Al Jazeera, Qatar's main news outlet, which is sort of pursuing legal action against the Egyptian government. But then Qatar also is, you know, seemed to want to partner somewhat with Egypt and some of the Arab states when we're talking about military intervention in Yemen. So there's been some interesting contradictions.
And just tell me a side point. The meeting is in Cairo. Is this Cairo coming back into its old position as the meeting point for all these nations? You know, 20, 30 years ago, if there was any diplomacy going on in the region, it always seemed to run through Cairo. Has that been reset?
I think it depends on what the nature of the meetings will be going forward. So, for example, if you look at the Gaza conference that happened last summer, my understanding is that there's not necessarily a will to have that happen here again, simply because we've seen a huge crackdown here on Hamas. You know, the Egyptian government has basically ruled them out as a terrorist organization. That's currently being debated in the Egyptian courts. But because of Hamas's ties to the Brotherhood and what this means for Gaza, that sort of international meeting doesn't appear to be, you know, there's no will to have that take place here again. But that was a donors conference. This kind of big regional diplomacy meeting, perhaps, I think Sisi likes the idea that he can be front and center with the Saudis and have that level of regional power once again.
That was Ruth Michelson on Monday's edition of The Briefing, talking to Andrew Tuck. The Briefing is broadcast every weekday at midday UK time. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. The UK heads to the polls in 5 weeks for what promises to be the tightest election since 1974. Ahead of the vote, Monocle is bringing you a series of roundtables on the Monocle Daily every Wednesday until May the 6th, the day before the UK decides. On Wednesday, we were joined in the studio by Paul Osborne, a regular contributor to Monocle 24 and a journalist who is covering the UK general election, and Sean Kemp, former head of media for the Liberal Democrats during the 2010 elections. They joined presenters Andrew Muller and Dominic Reynolds to discuss the vote and what it means for the UK.
The two main parties, Labour and Conservative, are both essentially neck and neck. It is very hard to see how either of them is going to make a big enough leap in the opinion polls to get a majority under the system we have here for elections. And they're not really trying to as well. If you look at their campaigns, they're actually appealing to their base, if you like. They're not really reaching out for undecided voters. They're just worrying about getting, say, sort of 34, 35% in the polls, which is not going to be enough for them to get a majority. So I think we're definitely not going to get a sort of the usual UK result, which is a one-party sort of strong majority government.
And we've learnt a bit in the last 5 years about coalition governments, and everybody has become an expert, both voters, people who talk about it, and of course the politicians themselves. And given that we are likely to experience another one of these, what's the difference between fighting a campaign as used to happen when you expect one party to be victorious and fighting one in which you anticipate to have to form a coalition afterwards?
Well, there's a few differences. The first one is the parties are all finding themselves being asked which of these policies are you definitely going to deliver in government and which ones will you ditch as part of the coalition negotiation.
Which is like the A-list and the B-list.
Everyone's being like basically asked to choose their darlings. There's a bit of that going on. It's also the journalists don't really care what's going on in the general election. It's been a really dull, actually, election week, because all anyone really wants to talk about is who might you do a deal with when we inevitably don't get a clear result.
A bit of a problem for messaging, isn't it?
Yeah, so you just spend 6 weeks. This used to be when I went for Liberal Democrats, because our only chance of power was always going in a coalition. So we were always being asked, who would you rather do a deal with, what policies would you ditch, and so on. For the other parties, this is quite a new experience. I think they're sort of finding it quite irritating. But, I mean, we're in a sort of new world now.
Paul, to bring you in, one thing which I guess has changed slightly since the last election is that the media landscape has accelerated and diversified still further from what was already a very accelerated and diverse media landscape in 2010. What's your sense of how the parties are adjusting to that? And does anyone strike you as doing it terribly well or terribly badly?
There are fewer staged events than there used to be in election campaigns. There was a real structure to general elections in Britain. What happened was all the parties, all the journalists used to troop to one party headquarters and hear what the Conservatives had to say, and then they'd all troop off to the next one and hear what Labour had to say, and then the Liberal Democrats. And they'd all set out their message for the day, and that would dictate the day. 7 a.m. they'd tell you, today we're going to talk about the economy. Today we're going to talk about housing. And then there'd be a series of staged photo events during the day with the intention of there being a nice little rounded TV package at the end of the day, we're talking about the economy. There's no point doing that anymore. It's now more about getting onto sofas for breakfast TV, getting out and about. It's about a unified core message that you can send out in 1,000 different ways. And the problem is so few people now...
There's an obvious problem with
well,
that.
So few people now compared to 15, 20 years ago watch the big evening TV news programmes. It used to be really simple. You just got a message that played out well at 10 o'clock at night on television and you'd hit half the voters every evening. But now you've got to be on television all the time, you've got to be on the radio all the time, you've got to be online all the time, and you're not as in control of the message as you used to be because you never know when something weird's going to come in online, when we're going to unearth something that a candidate once said on social media 12 years ago or something is going to send you off in a completely different direction.
This must be a key issue for journalists. It must be a real source of head-scratching for people on the other side of things. I mean, talk to us about, Sean, what has happened inside party HQs to try and respond to this sort of everybody has a Twitter account sort of situation and the type of landscape that Paul's describing.
Well, I mean, the Twitter really not took off at 2010, but the 2010 was the first election Twitter impacted on. But then it was much more, the impact was basically MPs saying colossally stupid things. And I mean, basically, I think every party had to get rid of one candidate because of some appalling, like, offensive remark they made on Twitter. This time, I think the problem is not just Twitter. It's broader than that, as we were just discussing. It's that in politics, you want to reach the undecided voter. That's the gold dust. That's what you're chasing. Problem is, you don't know where to find them anymore. The 10 o'clock news used to be the one you would aim to get on, because as we're just hearing, like, half the country is watching. That's not there anymore. And now people are picking their news channels online and the numerous radio stations they can listen to, the numerous kind of broadcasts they can watch. And they're picking ones that already agree with what their views are as well. So there isn't a kind of, there is no neutral media, if you like, with the exception of the BBC.
So you just have this echo chamber effect,
which is what's increasingly happened in the United States.
Yes, so Conservatives are talking to Conservative supporters, Labour are talking to Labour supporters, Liberal Democrats are just sort of waving their arms in the air trying to get anyone to notice them. and no one's sort of reaching what used to be the gold dust, which was that big pool of people trying to make up their minds. So they're trying to track them down and they're doing all sorts of weird things. They're trying to use Facebook more, they're trying to do very local newspaper type sort of stunts to try and get noticed. Just anything at all to try and sort of break out of the comfort zone.
That was Paul Osborne and Sean Kemp talking with Andrew Miller and Dominic Reynolds on Wednesday's edition of The Monocle Daily. You can hear the show every weeknight at 2200 hours UK time. Now, the 13th time in the last 10 years, Peru is looking for a new prime minister. The latest to have lost the job is Ana Jara, who had held the position ever since July last year, a relatively eternity in Peru's recent history. However, she has resigned after losing a vote of confidence in Peru's Congress. Ms. Jara's colleagues turned on her over an espionage scandal. It has emerged that Peru's intelligence agency possibly forewarned of anything better to do and for some years been spying on Peru's own political and business establishment. On Tuesday's edition of The Monocle Daily, Andrew Miller and Peter Cardwell were joined by Oscar Guardiola Rivera, senior lecturer in law at Birkbeck University here in London and all-round Latin America expert, to tell us why Peru just can't hold on to its leader.
What is known and has been proven is that both this government, the Humala government, and the two previous governments, the Toledo and the Garcia administrations, use taxpayers' funds to finance a branch of the intelligence service which was surveilling journalists, opposition politicians, pretty much everyone with some influence in Peru. And of course, that's forbidden by the constitution. And it does seem that the information that was being gathered had nothing to do with national security. It had everything to do with, as the editor of newspaper El Comercio put it, very unscrupulous aims.
If this has been going on for years, Why has the Prime Minister now taken the hit for it? What's the reason for that?
Well, the reason for it is constitutional.
Right.
The
person at the top must go.
Exactly. The Parliament can issue a vote of non-confidence, which is what they did. I mean, in fact, the Omala's party, the party of the President, doesn't have the majority. The majority in Parliament is held by, if you can believe it, the followers of President Fujimori, his daughter, who's standing for him. Fujimori's in prison, as we all know, or was. Put in prison and so on. And yet it seems that his legacy endures. So she has to go, the entire cabinet has to be reorganized. But most critics of Mr. Omala are saying that he is just refusing to recognize the depth of the crisis his government is in. He allows the prime minister to go, again, this is the seventh time, reorganizes the government and pretends that nothing is happening. But what is clear is that the government is absolutely up to its knees on all sorts of problems. This one, which is, of course, goes all the way back to the presidency. Most critics and the editorial of the main newspaper today did say that there was no way these intelligence services were doing what they did without the knowledge of the president. Also, on top of everything, this president has increased the funds for the intelligence branch on a 700% rate, which, of course, raises all sorts of questions. Why did he do so? Did he do so because he had something to hide, and so on and so forth?
Okay, so the Prime Minister has to go because she's the one who is sitting down when the music stops. That makes a certain amount of sense. Who is next in line for the job, or is it too early to tell that yet?
There are a couple of people. One is von Hesse, the other one. I mean, none of them are real heavyweights, but it does seem that this government will try and stumble from crisis upon crisis until the end of the period. Mind you, one additional fact why this doesn't make much sense. Mrs. Hara herself was being surveilled by the intelligence services.
Gosh, that's very unfair on her, really, isn't it?
Incredible. It's very...
She's had a
strange.
Rough old time.
She does have some sort of political responsibility, of course. She must have known, but it does seem unfair. In fact, Mario Vargas Llosa wrote a letter of congratulation to her saying, this corrupt Congress has done you the highest honor by letting you go.
She has said much the same herself, that it's something of a compliment to be unloaded by this particular Congress. I mean, you mentioned President Fujimori, the former president currently in prison, along with his intelligence chief, of course, Vladimir Montes. Does this scandal compare at all to that scandal? And is that scandal maybe the reason why Peru's lawmakers are so sensitive about this scandal?
It is the reason why they are so sensitive, though I wouldn't say compare with what Montesinos and Fujimori did. What they did was effectively directed a dirty war, and they issued orders to kill hundreds of people, which is not the case now. What we're seeing now is a case of illegal surveillance. But the problem goes deeper insofar as this would be the third administration involved in this problem. So newspapers, journalists in Peru are asking also the previous two presidents, Toledo and Garcia, to give explanations why all this money is being put into this branch of the intelligence services, why they have been used or misused or abused in this case.
That was our Andrew Miller and Peter Cardwell talking to Oscar Guardiola Rivera on Tuesday's edition of The Monocle Daily. You are listening to The Recap. Up next, a delve into the history of the library.
The brand new M24 iPhone app brings you the full radio offering from Monocle 24. Listen live to our four daily news programmes or catch the freshest tunes on our playlist. And of course, there's The Time Shift, where you can delve into our show archive and listen at your leisure. All our great magazine programmes covering everything from international affairs to culture, design to urbanism, food and drink to entrepreneurship. It's all available anytime on the new, free Monocle 24 iPhone app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You are listening to The Recap, where we look back at stories from the week gone by in live news shows here on Monocle 24. I am Markus Hippi. According to a survey in 2014 by the Department for Culture, Media and Sport in the UK, going to the library feels like getting a pay rise. Libraries around the world remain strong, but for that they are also changing and adapting to the 21st century, sometimes in unusual ways. Library lover Alex Johnson has written a book on this new library revolution. In Improbable Libraries, published by Thames and Hudson, the author goes around the world looking at significant and unusual libraries. On Tuesday's edition of the Monocle Daily, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco met with Johnson to learn how to do things by the book.
Technology means that you can move the idea of a library forward. So there are some examples in there of using QR codes, for example. There's one in the subway in New York where some students are designing quite a clever idea whereby when you're actually underground, you can swipe a QR code to look at a book and get the first chapter. Now, when you come out into the air, it sends you a message saying where the nearest actual physical book is available at a library. So I think there's an element where there's a conjunction of old media and new media there.
I was reading your book and I saw Bibliotaxi, you know, it's from São Paulo, which that's where I'm from. And
right.
So, I mean, can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, that's a marvellous idea. Is that the idea that libraries on the move can really suit different customers and different kinds of clientele. So the Bibliotaxi service is very simply that in Texas and Sao Paulo and other places now around in South America, people who are riding the back have a choice of books in little see-through envelopes on the back of the driver's seat, and they can sign in and sign out. And what started as a one-man band thing, really. I think it was just one taxi driver, has really mushroomed, and it's become very big now.
Yeah, indeed. Actually, when I was in São Paulo, I saw one of the cabs who were using the service.
Excellent.
So that's
good.
Quite interesting.
It's actually working. That's
exactly. It is. It is indeed. And it's interesting because, you know, you went all over the world. I want to talk about one in Laos, actually. It's the Elephantine Library. That's a fantastic concept.
Yeah, so I think that's probably one of my most favourite in the whole book there. Yes, the idea is that because it's hard to get some of these villages, well, in fact, more than hard, it's impossible to get through on tracks or by boat or any other way because of the terrain and the forest, that the elephant is the only way to actually get through there. So the library actually just comes on the elephant's back. And it's obviously marvellous. The children love it because as well as the books coming, it's obviously a bit of a laugh coming on the back of an elephant. But the whole setup is excellent because as well as a library, they're also a publishing house. So they're mixing lots of things together to bring literacy to people who otherwise would have difficulty finding it.
I would love to see myself the Elephantine Library, I have to say. And there's a chapter on that's very interesting as well, and I noticed that in libraries about their use of space, and some of them are actually quite tiny, but they make such a good use of space. You know, for example, there's an example given in the book, in Hampshire, where they have a phone box.
Yes, in Longstock. Yes, that's an interesting scheme because these are the old BT telephone kiosks, which are largely redundant now as mobile phones are taking over the world. There are about 90,000 around the country, and about half of them have been decommissioned. But about 2,000 of those now have been turned into community sites for various things. So some little communities have turned them into mini art galleries or tea rooms or defibrillator areas. But a lot of them have been turned into these community libraries that people can go in and borrow books and take them and bring them back. And it's providing, especially for the more rural areas, it's providing real service.
Do you have a personal favourite library?
I like the elephant ones. I think that's an excellent one. I like the ones that are really serving a community in a different way. So in Cornwall, for example, there are various pubs which are running community libraries, partly as an outreach service from the main library service in the county. But I think that's a really good example of being somewhere where people are, rather than forcing people to come to you, going out to where people are actually spending time and will use the books. And they're proving very successful.
That was Fernando Augusto Pacheco speaking to Alex Johnson, author of Improbable Libraries, broadcast on Tuesday's edition of the Monocle Daily. You are listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. I am Markus Hippi. Now, we love a good statistic here on Monocle 24, and especially those that buck a trend or are even quite unexplainable. It emerged from a poll this week that a third of Russians still respect murderous tyrant Joseph Stalin, and nearly half of Russians think his terror was justified. It's a baffling story, seeing as Stalin was arguably responsible for millions of deaths of ordinary Russians. On Thursday, edition of Midori House, Andrew Müller was joined by Nina Schick of Open Europe to discuss why, incredibly, Joseph Stalin continues to have lasting appeal.
I think the kind of particularly boisterous brand of nationalism that Putin has been unleashing in Russia recently also, you know, really taps into that sentiment of fighting against the fascists, you know, which is what they call, you know,
the
forces in eastern Ukraine. So it certainly has a historical link about the Soviet Union fighting against Nazi Germany. And I also think there have been people on Russia's right who have been supportive of Stalin over a long period of time, but it certainly coincides with what recent geopolitical and developments in Ukraine, that Stalin's popularity has increased now. I think it was up 25% in the last 3 years.
Extraordinarily so. Is there anything we can learn from this, or that the EU could learn from this, about how to deal with Russia and with Putin?
Well, they've made an extraordinary mess of it. I mean, in the very beginning, I keep saying this whenever I'm asked about the current Ukraine crisis, you know, in the very, very beginning, the EU miscalculated. I mean, they only needed to study Russian history for 10 minutes to realize that what happens in Ukraine is far more important to Russia than it ever will be to the EU. And by giving Ukraine a binary choice between either, you know, becoming closer to the EU or Russia, giving them an all or nothing choice, they've played a lot in the way the current situation has happened.
That was Andrew Müller talking to Nina Schick. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. We end today's programme with a visit to Theatreland, courtesy of Monocle editor Andrew Tuck. On Wednesday morning's Globalist, Andrew recalled the night before at the theatre, where he had just seen Kevin Spacey's performance at London's Old Vic Theatre as Clarence Darrow. Over to Andrew now for a real showstopper.
I just went to see Kevin Spacey in one of his final performances at the Old Vic Theatre in London, playing the role of the real-life civil rights lawyer, Clarence Darrow. It was a packed Friday night, and sure, people were already up for having a good time, for being wooed by Mr. Spacey. But you could sense, as the minutes passed, that he was taking a theatre full of disparate people on a journey together. We may have had days that varied from crap to celebratory, but in that theatre, Spacey had the presence and the agility to make us forget what existed outside the theatre's walls, even if just for a couple of hours, to unify us in a moment, to have our attention in an age when concentration is the rarest of commodities, society's rare metal. So, every now and then, I would let myself look at the faces of the people sat around me. Don't worry, no craning of necks required. This was theatre in the round. The same emotions were playing out across hundreds and hundreds of faces. He had us strapped to a roller coaster, and we were following his every word. We laughed in unison, shuddered together. From the group of people who looked like they'd just left their desks in some city bank, to the school kids up in the gods, everyone on the same page. It's something I find as moving as the experience on the stage, and which surely must be intoxicating for any performer who is able to cast this spell, to magic us into wonder. Even after Spacey had taken his final bow, that feeling of unity among the audience glowed, people buzzing, happy, thrilled at what they had seen. But we had made the evening too. Acting in unison is a glorious thing. In the dark, something amazing had happened. And in his dressing room, I hope Mr. Spacey knew that this was an incredible evening. For Monocle, I'm Andrew Tuck.
Well, that's all we've got time for on this week's episode of The Recap. The show was produced by Tom Hall and edited by Sam Impey. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programmes here on Monocle 24. But for now, from me, Markus Hippi, thank you for listening and goodbye.